Hi, I'm Nicole Ferraro, and this is The Divide, a podcast from Light Reading exploring the ongoing digital divide, why and where it still exists, and what needs to be done to get people everywhere connected to reliable, high-speed internet. Today, I'm joined by Gene Cruzy, CEO of Surf Internet, an internet service provider that's been around in various forms since the early 90s, and today delivers broadband service in Indiana, Michigan, and Illinois. He joins the podcast to discuss the history of Surf, as well as when and why Surf started deploying fiber to the premises. We also discuss the company's strategy of using a blend of private and public funds to reach unserved and underserved communities, how and where Surf is planning to participate in the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, or BEAD, and much more. Gene, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you. I've been curious about all things Surf for a while. So to start off, why don't you give me some background on Surf as well as yourself? I heard that you were recently introduced as the founder of the internet, the inventor of the internet. So why don't you tell me more about that? You might be stealing that title from some others. So let's hear all about you and Surf.
Yeah, Nicole, thanks for having me. And we'll give Al Gore the credit for inventing the internet, as we all know. But I was speaking at a local service club, and the guy that invited me said, give me your bio or I can just make something up. And I said, making something up would be way more fun. And so I got up and he's like, I want to introduce you to Gene Cruzy. He's a CEO of Surf and he invented the internet. And while we clearly know that's not true, it is kind of an interesting connection, because Surf, we got our roots back all the way in the early 1990s, actually. And so for many communities, we brought in the first broadband connection, which at the time was 1 meg or 2 megs or 5 megs via fixed wireless. And one of my favorite stories I like to tell, and I'll try to do it quickly because I know we don't have a lot of time, is we actually got started because we were a dial-up ISP and a local manufacturer called us. And I think you've been in the broadband space for a while. You might remember the days before the internet, there was this thing called Gopher, and Gopher was a text-based search. And so this manufacturer wanted to make their equipment documents, text, available on Gopher, but they needed a dedicated internet connection to keep it fresh. And the local phone company couldn't figure out how to deliver a dedicated internet in like 1994. And so I've always had a fascination with radio and communication. And so figured out how to hack these wireless print sharing devices to create a 900 megahertz internet link that went from one little town to another little town. And that was probably like 1994, 1995. And why that's so important is shortly after we got that connection going, our phone started ringing like crazy. People were like, hey, I heard you figured out how to do internet over wireless. And I'm not saying we invented that either. We just figured out how to do it pretty early. And so from about the mid-90s through around 2000, we set out building a bunch of ISPs all across the U.S., specifically in the Midwest, but as far west as like Missouri and Kansas and whatnot. And then I would say probably around 1999, I realized that we were putting so much energy into building networks for other people that we were missing an opportunity to build a network in our own community. And so we set out in 1999 and incorporated a business called MapleNet Wireless. We were two things. We were a value-added reseller, and we were also a fixed wireless ISP and dial-up ISP. We grew that business for a number of years and realized that in the early days of internet, it was a wild west, and the technology really wasn't very mature. And so essentially, when we would connect a customer or disconnect a customer, we'd actually have to connect to that customer's CPE device and disable the Ethernet port. And it was very manual, not very scalable at all. So in 2007, we sold off that business to focus on commercial connectivity, and we had also gotten into E-rate, which is using a federal subsidy to provide connectivity for schools. And over time, we became the fifth largest E-rate provider in Indiana and Illinois. Anyways, one of the companies that was looking at buying our resi business was a guy by the name of Greg Armstrong that owned a business called Surf Air Wireless. And he didn't actually end up buying our business, but we became partners. We started doing a lot of fixed wireless integration work for him. And then in 2015, we decided to put our businesses together to form a company called Surf Air Wireless. Mm-hmm. And the goal then in 2015 was to go out and buy as many fixed wireless operators as we could in the Great Lakes region to create a Great Lakes area fixed wireless ISP business. So we merged in 2016. We did 10 acquisitions between 2016 and 2018. Then in 2018, we came across a large acquisition in Michigan that required some outside funding. So we hired an investment banker group, which at the time was called MVP Capital. It's mm-hmm. now become Houlihan Lokey. And they introduced us to a group called Post Road Group. Post Road Group came on board with $40 million of investment that initially was actually earmarked to do fixed wireless acquisitions. But what we saw at the time, Connect America Fund was kind of rolling through, and there's some talk about some other subsidies. And there was a hockey fan on our management team, and he said, Wayne Gretzky always says, skate to where the puck is going. And so we're not the smartest people on the planet, but we saw that generally fiber, the government and subsidy thought that fiber was the potential for the future. So in 2018, we did a massive business pivot from resi fixed wireless and resi E-rate and commercial to a strategy that we set out to try to win as many anchor institutions with fiber as possible. And so we went out from 2018, 2019, and we won just a bunch of commercial connectivity. We also won a bunch of school accounts where we built a middle mile fiber network to connect those schools. And then we started building our first residential fiber to the home network in 2019. It was about 100 homes in a rural subdivision. In like 60 days, we got 100% of the population. Like everybody wanted fiber. At the time, it was 100 meg fiber to the home, capable of a gig, but the Wi-Fi hadn't really caught up yet. Anyways, fast forward, and we did maybe 5,000 passings of fiber to the home, sort of had this big middle mile network laid out. And so then in 2021, we went back out to the investment world. And we said to the investment world, look, we have this vision to build fiber to the home on top of our middle mile network that's in Indiana, Michigan, and Illinois. And we believe there's about 2 million households that we could be near with our fiber. So Bain Capital Credit came on board in 2021, closed in 2022, and funded our growth. And we ended up building fiber past about 66,000 homes between 2022 and 2023. Then we went back out to the market to bring in a senior debt facility, which was Digital Bridge Credit. They came on board with $100 million of debt that funded our growth to where we are today, which is about 50,000 subscribers, about 130,000 fiber to the home passings. And we're on track this year to build about 70,000 additional fiber to the home passings, which will put us at about 200,000 by the end of the year.
Wow. What a fascinating history that has really spanned all types of technologies in many ways and gotten you to this point where you really fit in with, I guess, by following Wayne Gretzky's advice, you found yourself perfectly positioned for the place we're in today in terms of how we're expanding with fiber and all these locations. But before I get ahead of myself, I'm curious, what types of regions are you typically serving? Are you looking for underserved regions, unserved, or what how do you make a decision of where to go territorially?
Yeah, that's a great question. We believe that broadband is a great equalizer, and it, regardless of your skin color, how much you make, or where you live, it equalizes the playing field so that everybody has access to the same resources. And so we actually use that to make our decisions about where we want to be. And we're all incredibly proud. I know you're from New York, and you're probably very proud to be a New Yorker. We're from the Great Lakes region, and we're very proud to be from the Great Lakes region. You know, having the largest freshwater lakes in the world right here in our backyard and all the resources that that brings. So we want to be contiguous in the Great Lakes region, and we think it's really important for our brand. And also, we just want to live, work, and play in the communities where we're building fiber. So all that to say, now, how do we pick a market? Well, we know that our friends at Metronet and some of the larger fiber builders are going after the NFL cities and the slightly bigger cities. And then our friends at the rural electric co-ops are generally building some of the rural ground. But yeah, really the small communities in the Midwest, the 500 to 5,000 household communities, are getting overlooked by the big guys and the small guys. And so we've crafted a strategy that says, let's go and be the first fiber provider in a small community that already has cable, has an ILEC that hasn't yet built fiber. So by ILEC, I mean a phone company. And then we definitely want to be the first fiber provider in a community. But what we really look for is a place where we can be significantly impactful on the region. So if it was just a small town that is in the middle of Illinois and there's really nothing else around, we might be interested in that. But what we're more interested in is in where there's a group of communities that also has a rural unserved population in the middle where 1 + 1 = more than 2. So you just saw a press release last week. So this is, we're recording this in April. So we just announced that we're building out Dowagiac, Michigan, which is part of about 10 small communities that together become a regional network, not only fiber home in that community, but more rural. And then also there's some nearby BEAD opportunity as well.
Okay. Okay. So let's segue then actually and talk about the role of grants in your builds, mm-hmm. and then we can get to the BEAD program specifically. Absolutely. But you mentioned already your partnerships with various equity firms. So obviously that's helping to fund some of your build outs, but I believe you guys are also getting some state grants, some ARPA grants and otherwise.
That's right.
So talk to me a bit about the existing grants that you're already, you have won and you're building out with.
Yeah, absolutely. So today we've won around $40 million in grant funding that we've matched with $26 million of private funding. So mm-hmm. if you think about the economic impact of that, it's really like $66 million. So very significant in the Midwest. So we'll start with the state of Michigan. We won a $17 million grant from Michigan through the Robin Grant program. That Robin Grant that we won is in Livingston County. And what's just so cool about that is we had already built some municipal fiber in Fowlerville, and through local ARPA grants, through local townships, we had served a bunch of the townships around Fowlerville and Howell. So, mm-hmm. And we had also started building fiber in Howell, and we then just last year acquired a small fiber provider in Howell called MI Signal. So collectively then we had this nice footprint in Howell, this nice footprint in Fowlerville, a number of rural builds that were funded by local townships. And then this Robin Grant came in and tied the whole thing together. So the Robin Grant itself will serve somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 subscriber or passings. But collectively, because SURF is backed by solid investors that see the future of fiber, it's actually going to probably bring us in a neighborhood of 30,000 passings by the time we build out the rest of Howell, the rest of Fowlerville, the towns of Fenton and Linden and just all the surrounding communities, the impact is more like 30,000 passings. So that's the one area in Michigan. In Indiana, we've won 3 state grants so far through the Indiana Next Level Connect grant program. One was in the area of Elkhart County, one was in the area of LaPorte County, and one was in the area of Newton County. And the Newton County one is really a special project to talk about. So remember, I mentioned that we had a strategy to build E-rate fiber for schools.
Yeah.
So in 2019, we won the school district, which is North Newton School District. We built a WAN that interconnected their schools in a very rural part of Newton County. Because we did that, we had a backbone in place that when Next Level Connection came out, we were able to bid on and win about $1 million in funding to cover northern parts of that county. That grant then put us near the town of Lake Village in Roselawn, which had enough density that we could build with our own private capital. That collective investment got the attention of the county, and we negotiated a deal with the county. We just received our first payment last week for a $4 million grant that basically amplifies the impact of the E-rate project and also of the Next Level Connection project. And by the time we're done, which by the way, we're already over halfway done with that project, we will serve 97% of the households in Newton County. And wow. If you don't know Newton County is an area where there may be areas with less than one home per mile.
Okay. Yeah.
So very, very rural. And yeah. The last 3% is going to be the hardest 3% to cover because they are so rural. And so for today, because we have a CBRS license in that county, we're going to have fiber to the tower and fixed wireless for that remaining 3% that are very difficult to serve. Now, we have a pending Next Level Connect Round 4 grant that we should learn about the challenge process in the coming days. If that's funded, we will actually have 100% of the county covered with fiber, and okay, we will no longer need our fixed wireless deployment there.
Okay, very interesting. So what I'm getting from you is to make those, you know, super sparse deployments work for you economically, you need a mix of forward thinking about, you know, how this connects to other parts of your service areas, as well as some level of grant funding. And what else, you know, to sustain, let's say, to sustain those yep, households that you're going to connect with fiber, what does a company like Surf need to make that worthwhile? You know, knowing that so many homes and locations have been neglected because the economic case isn't there. Of course, these grants are supposed to help us get part of the way. But over the long term, how do you sustain, you know, your decision to go out in an area like that and build fiber to the home?
Yeah, you know, I think the recent defunding of the ACP or lack of funding or whatever is going to become a real sensitive topic for rural America, because as we look at our customer demographics, we logic would say that inner city urban areas is where the ACP participation would be, partly because of where we build fiber and partly because the areas that we're building fiber tend to have maybe a lower income in the rural areas. But we have a fair bit of ACP participation in rural America. And so the lack of having that that subsidy is going to make adoption slightly more challenging for rural America. So, you know, my hope and prayer is that government finds a way to restore that program, because it is really critical to rural America. But besides that, we generally have very high take rate by rural community. And because we live, work, and play in those communities, we have team members that are there. So the cost of supporting the network is lower. And because we were very strategic about having a middle mile network up front, we're less dependent on third party carriers. So our operational costs are lower. So it's really a whole playbook about how do we build a sustainable fiber network. And, you know, the BEAD is about access and making sure people get access. I think we're getting really good at that. But a part of that then is adoption. And some part of adoption is through ACP and making it more affordable so people can adopt. But some part of it, and the part that I think is most difficult to challenge, and I am not an expert at this, but we're taking little baby steps in trying to work on this, is education. So I'll give you a really solid example. In 2022, we partnered with a local school district to build fiber to the home in a community that is probably the poorest in that district, very, very low income. And the superintendent in that area said, during COVID, we had to park a school bus. You know, you've heard the story. We parked a school bus on the street so kids could get internet access. And so as a test, we went in and deployed fiber to the home in that area, you know, with ACP and our lowest entry price. Residents in that community could get 100 meg fiber for $5. And what we found is that adoption was really, really low. And so through education and partnering with the schools, we also are experimenting with community centers and food pantries. And we're definitely not the experts of this, but we're currently partnering with this group called Horizon Education Alliance, who basically looks at a holistic approach to how do we elevate the quality of life for the whole community. And one way to do that is through education. And so circle that all the way around to say some part of the future will be teaching people who live in unserved, underprivileged areas how to use the internet. Mm-hmm. And so an example is I use home banking on my phone, on the internet. My wife knows exactly what my son's grades are in school. He's a senior. He's got senioritis, so she's watching every day to see where he's at. And but what we found is economically disadvantaged folks don't use the internet the same way that my family does. Mm-hmm. And so if we can help them understand some of the advantages, not only from working from home and telehealth and all that stuff, but simply just making life easier by checking your bank balance or making an appointment with your doctor, that will ultimately drive up adoption. So we're working with Horizon Education Alliance. We're working with the Tolson Community Center. We're engaging with community centers and food pantries across our coverage area to to figure it out. And there's no silver bullet, and we don't know how to do it. But together, if we keep trying, maybe we'll make a little bit of a difference that'll make the world a slightly better place.
I think that it's notable that you're even doing that, that you're making those partnerships, because that is a big piece of the puzzle. And, you know, ISPs, even wonderful ones like Surf Internet, don't have the greatest reputation, you know, not you individually, but ISPs right. specifically. So having trusted partners is an important part of all of this. And I appreciate you mentioning the ACP. I'm normally leading my guests into a conversation about the ACP, and you brought it up independently. So I appreciate that. Let me just fill in the blanks for anyone who may be listening is not sure, but the ACP is, of course, the Affordable Connectivity Program. And as we are speaking right now on April 22nd, we are mere days away from the thing running out of funding. It's going to go to partial funding in May. And Congress could simply pass the bill that's sitting there waiting for them to pass it to fund the program for the rest of the year. But seems unlikely. And the damage is frankly done because, you know, all of these customers have already gotten letters confusing them about what's going on and whatever. So yes, the loss of the ACP is going to be a big problem for the families that rely on it and providers like you guys and others who are trying to service rural areas. And that leads me to our last topic, which is the BEAD program, which mm-hmm. you brought up earlier, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. The ACP is sort of, you know, part of what's supposed to make BEAD, you know, function as a program. So we'll see how all that plays out. But let's leave that aside for the moment and just talk to me about your plans to participate in BEAD. You mentioned that there are a couple of service areas you're already in where you see BEAD possibilities. So tell me a bit about your plans there and how you're already engaging with state broadband offices, as well as any hurdles. You know, I've heard a bunch of concerns about participation in BEAD, so I'd love to hear what you're worried about, or maybe you have no worries. I'll let you talk. Go ahead.
Yeah, the worst words in the human language are, I work for the government and I'm here to help.
Right.
You know, at the state broadband level, I've been really impressed with how passionate the broadband offices really are. Like, they want to do the right thing. And I think if it were up to them, they will. And I hope the federal government will find ways to streamline the process. There's one thing on ACP I just want to hit on real quickly, Nicole, because I think it's super important. So the FCC passed, or at least has this mandate to eliminate digital discrimination.
Yes.
And so on one hand, they're saying service providers, you can't discriminate by what neighborhood you choose to go into. And then on the other hand, they're saying, well, we're not going to help you pay for it either. And it's an interesting dilemma that us service providers have, because we want all people to have access to internet regardless. And it's just super interesting that they're saying do this, but then we're not going to help. So that I want to get that off my plate because it really has caused some sleepless nights.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of BEAD, our board has authorized us to pursue up to $300 million in BEAD across three states. We already have the areas identified. We know pretty much where we would be interested in going. But at the late stage of this podcast where we're talking out in our area, Indiana, Michigan, and Illinois are all in various places in their BEAD challenge process. But one thing that has emerged, and I'm sure you've seen it in the press, is that certain operators are exaggerating their coverage.
Yeah.
And so I live in Elkhart County, Indiana. Elkhart County has a pretty big Amish population, you know, lack of electricity, all that kind of stuff on two different sides of the county. And so in our entire county, which has a population of about 200,000, there's only 800 BEAD eligible addresses in the entire county. Now, what I know, because I live here and our phone rings every day, is there's probably more like 4,000 households that don't have access to broadband, mm-hmm. but certain other providers are advertising fixed wireless coverage in those areas when it probably is available like widely, but not specifically at every single address. So one of my top concerns is that if that's left unchecked, and I'm all for accurate mapping. If an address is served, it's served, that's great. But if it's not, it's potentially going to eliminate big chunks of Indiana and big chunks of Michigan. We're not quite on Illinois yet, but we're really focused on Indiana, Michigan. So we're part of a group that really is working with a local broadband task force to challenge those providers on a very specific address basis. And so, you know, to be determined on kind of what happens with that. Another ginormous concern I have, if that's a word, is...
it is. Go on.
If it's not, we just made it up. Just like we invented the internet, we're going to make that word up. But there are a number of RDOF winners who have yet to really start building their network. And what I think is going on is that they're waiting to see how much state funding they can get and how much BEAD funding they can get to... Maybe they bid on a bad design or a bad business plan and RDOF. And so now they're hoping to recover by putting all this stuff together. You know, when SURF participated in RDOF, when the pricing got below a certain level, we said, we can't do it for that price. We're just going to back out. And so all of us collectively that participated knew what our boundaries were. And but my fear is this: we're going to get past the BEAD challenge period. RDOF isn't going to get built. That provider is not going to get BEAD funding. And so then they're going to fail on their RDOF commitments. And so then that whole area is not going to get RDOF. It's not going to get BEAD. And it's going to be left unserved again. Another concern about BEAD is environmental. So I don't know if any of your other guests have talked about this, but an ironic thing is that these roads are built and we're putting fiber along the road, but because of the guidelines for environmental and historic preservation, you have to do some kind of environmental study to put fiber next to the road that certainly had an environmental study done when the road was put in. So if nothing else, that's going to add cost and it's going to add delay. So, you know, lastly, our strategy is we're going to participate in BEAD, but we're actually reaching out to communities right now. We're talking to tons of them. And just last week, two different communities in two different states said, we have this pile of money sitting in our ARPA fund, and we were setting it aside for BEAD, but we see now that BEAD's not really gonna hit the street till 2025. And we believe that SURF can do this faster, as is the case with Newton County, where the grant was approved a few months ago, and we're 50% done, and we'll be mostly done by the end of the year.
Yeah.
Where else does government money go from a thought to practice in just a few months? Right. So BEAD will be impactful. It's not probably the once in a generational opportunity that everybody thinks. It will definitely move the needle. My biggest fear is that the government funded CAF and they funded RDOF. And before that, they funded BTOP and all the other stuff. We keep just putting Band-Aids on a problem. I keep paying to fix the same thing over and over and over. And so I don't really know the solution because it's much bigger than $42 billion, but we're going to do our very best to take baby bites out of that apple.
Oh, man. I could follow up with you and force you to talk to me for another hour, but I'm going to say thank you so much and set you free on that note and just hope that you'll come back after all this stuff gets going and talk to us about how it's going, because I think you are in a very interesting position here and you have a lot of great insights on what's going on. So thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me and for all the great work you're doing in Michigan, Illinois, and Indiana.
Thanks, Nicole. Great to be here.
Thank you again, Gene, for joining me. Thank you as well to our producer for this episode, Mark Pagan. Be sure to subscribe to the Light Reading Podcast for more episodes of The Divide, as well as interviews and insights from the Light Reading team. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.